Support for WPR comes from the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art, an independent organization dedicated to creating experiences that educate, reflect, and inspire. More is at mmoca.org.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The book is considered one of humanity's greatest creations, and a lot of people would say that war is one of our worst. But according to our next guest, the two are more interconnected than we think. In his new book, he traces the role that the printed word has played in conflicts around the globe, in propaganda, as a military target, as a pastime on the front line and the home front, and much more. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you seek out books about war, either fiction or nonfiction? Have you read any historically significant books that played central roles in the wars of the past? If you've served in the military yourself, did books help relieve the stress and or the tedium? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Andrew Pettigrew is an award-winning author and professor of modern history at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. His newest book is called The Book at War, How Reading Shaped Conflict and Conflict Shaped Reading. Andrew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Very pleased to be with you. Thanks for the invitation.
One of the first assumptions you tackle in the book is the idea that books are inherently peaceful. Why do we usually think that? And how have books really been wrapped up so much in violence and conflict?
Well, I think all through the history of book ownership, they've been, for many people, a marker of civilization, as I think are libraries, which is why any attempt to close a public library or to cut its hours is always greeted by howls of protest, even by people who don't truthfully regularly use those libraries. So people think of print culture as a uniquely civilizing influence, and don't take into consideration the fact that dictatorships are as aware of the value of books as are democracies.
You focus in a lot on the era before World War I and the books written for grown-ups and for kids, and how much they, in many ways, prepared people, got people excited even for the concept of war. Can you talk a little bit about how so many countries follow that path?
Yes, between about 1870 and the outbreak of the First World War, there weren't a lot of conflicts between frontline great powers. In Europe, at least in Western Europe, it was largely a peaceful period, and most of the conflicts were imperial conflicts between Western armies and local peoples in the areas that they had added to their empires. So in this period of relative peace, people felt pretty good about themselves in places like Germany and Britain. And if they felt less good, it was because they thought they hadn't had their fair share of the imperial cake when the rest of the world had been sliced and diced. So there was a sort of literature of glorification, if you like, of imperialism, often cunningly disguised in boys' magazines, where young heroes went out into the colonies and showed their natural leadership abilities. So it was a period which valued leadership skills, it valued courage, and it valued self-sacrifice. So this is what led so many people to rush into recruitment offices when the First World War broke out, with, as we now know, tragic consequences.
And World War One itself, when we look back and think of the literature and the poetry that came out of that, I think we might think of what came out of the end of it and the regret and the horror of war. You point out it's estimated that there was an explosion, like 50,000 poems a day, or so, I can't remember the exact number of, in most cases, pro-war poetry. There was an explosion of very positive war print at the outset of that war.
Yeah, what we find in both the First and Second World Wars is that whatever people thought before the war about the prospect of going to war, and in 1939, people were incredibly terrified of another war, not least because they feared bombing would be much more effective. Nevertheless, all of the professional groups in society, the lawyers, the judges, the police, the authors, the publishers, students, professors, they all rallied to the patriotic cause of their own nation. And in total war, everyone is vulnerable, but it also means that everybody wants to do their piece to play their part. And this comes in very many different ways. Sometimes it consists of rummaging around in your cupboards to find some books, either to give, to be sent to the troops, or to be pulped, to be recycled into the war effort. And I found in my investigations that actually more books were lost through the salvage operations, where all these books were gathered to be recycled, than actually as victims of the bombing, which is a rather extraordinary fact.
When people think of World War II and books, they might think of the book burnings, of course, in Nazi Germany. Shocked the world in many ways. It served as a symbol of the Nazi regime. You have an image of that. You also have an image from Baraboo, Wisconsin, 1918, where people are burning German language books with a large German immigrant population here in Wisconsin. Can you talk a little bit about that maybe lesser known wave of book burning here in the U.S.?
Well, my apologies to for singling out Baraboo, but yes, when the United States joined the conflict in 1917, there was an enormous amount of pent-up energy to be put into raising the money for the troops, for collecting books for the troops. But this also had its negative impact in the sense that German neighbors or neighbors of German heritage suddenly found themselves very coldly received. And one consequence of that, and this again comes down to trying to do something, was a clear out of German language books in the public libraries and often too in school libraries. Now, that is something which I'm afraid the American public had largely forgotten by the time of the Nazi book burning. So they reacted very, very adversely to when they heard of the Nazi book burnings. Demonstrations were held, but without reflecting too much on their own context.
Andrew Pettigrew is with us. His new book is called The Book at War, How Reading Shaped Conflict and Conflict Shaped Reading. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Andrew, you look at the book as a wide concept, hardcover books, softcover books, and pamphlets and maps. I want to give a listen here to President Franklin Roosevelt speaking in February 1942, 2 months after Pearl Harbor, looking at the Pacific theater of war.
It is warfare in terms of every continent, every island, every sea, every air lane in the world. That is the reason why I have asked you to take out and spread before you a map of the whole earth and to follow me in the references which I shall make to the world-encircling battle lines of this war.
FDR says to take out your maps, and in your introduction, I believe you mentioned that maps, atlases, globes sold out pretty much over the next week after that speech.
Well, thank you for finding that clip. It's wonderful to hear it. Yes, FDR was a tremendously empathetic speaker and judge of his electorate. And he knew that once America was at war, everybody would want to know what was going on. But here was the problem, that in many respects, America found itself woefully underprepared in terms of their knowledge of the Pacific islands and atolls where their boys would be sent to fight. And at one point, they adopted the rather desperate maneuver of asking the public to send in their holiday snaps and guidebooks in the hope that this would improve knowledge of, for instance, the Solomon Isles. And that wasn't much use. What happened was that the librarian of the Library of Congress then organized a scheme whereby this never happened again. So he gathered together the major public and university libraries, and each of them was designated a sphere of collecting, so that all the books, let's say, on India would be collected by one library, and so on and so forth, so that if they found themselves once again in an unexpected naval or land war against anywhere on the globe, they would at least have the resources with which to fight such a war. And it does bring home how important knowledge of every square mile of the world's territory is essential if you're going to be prepared for these sometimes not well-anticipated conflicts.
Andrew Pettigrew is with us. His new book is called The Book at War, How Reading Shaped Conflict and Conflict Shaped Reading. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your opinion of wartime censorship? We've heard of a couple of examples so far. Are there books you think were justified in being taken off shelves or destroyed during wartime? Have you served in the military? How important were books for you as recreation, maybe during your deployment? We'll talk about that in just a bit. You could join in with your experiences or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up the conversation with Andrew Pettigrew from the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, professor of modern history there, looking at his new book. It's called The Book at War, How Reading Shaped Conflict, Conflict Shaped Reading. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you read an influential book about war, fiction or nonfiction? If you've served in the military, maybe overseas during a conflict or peacetime, was reading a part of the way you passed the time? Join in at 800-642-1234. Andrew, something I learned, one of the many things I learned in your book, just a few days after the D-Day invasion during World War II, ships brought in critical supplies, crates and crates of books for the troops to read. This is something you focus on a lot, the role that reading played for troops during wartime. Tell us a little bit of what you found.
Well, the American service editions, which were the books that were coming ashore, one of those most remarkable ventures of the war. It had become clear that the books given to these book drives weren't really the sort of things that the troops wanted to read, and they were sort of hardback books which it was difficult to fit anywhere into your gear. So instead, the Army and the Navy got together and they commissioned what was ultimately a series of 1,000 different titles, mostly of modern fiction, but some classics, some non-fiction titles. And these were published in significant editions in a paperback format, which was made to go into the pocket of their combat trousers. And then these were just given away free of charge to troops wherever they were outside the United States. And getting them to these small detachments on numerous Pacific islands was an extraordinary logistical triumph. And they were enormously popular, something like 122 million copies of these books were published.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Justin is with us in Menominee. Justin, hello.
Yes, I just was wondering if you had any insight on how anti-war kind of poetry such as that by like Siegfried Sassoon, Counterattack and Other Poems and other, you know, remarque on sort of the German side here of World War One, how that impacted European perceptions of war.
Oh, interesting question, Justin. And that is something that you get into in the book, Andrew.
Yes, well, thank you very much for that question. It is indeed extremely interesting. What I would say is the normal pattern is that this sort of literature of reflection and regret tends to follow about a decade after the war is over. And it's then when people are sufficiently detached for it to be able to think through these consequences without seeming unpatriotic. And it's certainly the case with Sigrid Sassoon and Hymark and all the other authors of the First World War pity of war school, if you like. They didn't sell particularly well at the time, it must be said. And they sort of came back into favour in the 1960s, when the general climate was much more susceptible to anti-war sentiment. But then, you know, we have to remember that the same is pretty much true of the Vietnam War, when a lot of the best writing about Vietnam came long after the conflict had failed. At the time, the American people were much more supportive of the war than we've come to think of it in retrospect.
Justin, thanks for that call. We're talking to historian Andrew Pettigrew about his new book, The Book at War, How Reading Shaped Conflict and Conflict Shaped Reading. Andrew, there's a lot of attention to books that get censored during wartime. Something that surprised me was that in the run-up to World War II, Hitler's book Mein Kampf was a bestseller in England, and for at least some of the Allied troops, it was not banned. The sense, I think, that the more you read this, the more you're going to want to stop Hitler. Could you talk about that decision a little bit?
Well, the first complete translation of Mein Kampf into English only occurred in 1938-1939. Before, there'd been a heavily sanitized version. So FDR, for one, was certainly should be a full version so people could see the full impact of what Hitler was saying. In consequence, far from being banned, Mein Kampf was put on recommended reading lists for camp libraries when army camps were set up all around Britain. With that exception, I would say that these wartime censorship is more similar in the dictatorships and the democracies than one might imagine. But it mostly was imposed on the newspapers rather than the books. A couple of books in Britain were withdrawn, not because they were pro-German, but because it was thought the plot line might cause the Germans to realize that the secret of Enigma had been broken and the Brits were listening to German transmissions. Now, that was rather paranoid, but it does show how important it was seen to be to keep the secret of Enigma as long as possible. And in fact, it was the Germans didn't really know the extent to which the British and Americans were listening to their traffic until after the war.
During wartime, you write that people do a lot of reading, whether at home or on the front. Did people seem to prefer books about war or books about anything but war to escape that reality for a while?
I think it differs a little bit. On the home front, there was interest in every aspect of the war. You know, why France fell in 1940, why the Finns had put up such a good fight against the Russians in 1939. When Russia joined the war, there was a surge of books about Russia published in Britain. So, you know, on a home front, I think there is enormous interest in what's going on, and that caused a considerable reorientation of the publishing industry, to take that into account. I think troops were more interested in recreational reading, and I think in newspapers. That was a very important part in their lives. And special newspapers for the troops became a feature of the Allied forces, with, once again, the very well-resourced troops of the United States having a particularly strong performance in terms of truce newspapers, not least Stars and Stripes, which was distributed throughout the world.
And just our last couple of minutes, Andrew, books and libraries of books, collections, were often targets in wartime. Why did we see, in some cases, bombing campaigns and other efforts to destroy books on the enemy's side?
Well, in one respect, books were bound to be collateral damage. If you've got sort of unrestricted bombing warfare, because libraries have premises often in the city centres, often rather splendid buildings, they're almost certain to be attacked. But on the other hand, libraries were also important war resources. The New York Public Library, for instance, had one of the best map collections in the United States. It was bound to be used for military purposes. When the German Luftwaffe destroyed the center of Coventry, including its public library, they were destroying many people's houses. Many people lost their lives, but it also destroyed one of the great collections of technical industrial literature in the Coventry Public Library. It's not as if libraries weren't playing a role in the war.
Andrew, just in our last few minutes, do you think these issues are still relevant now in the internet age and how we think of books in conflict?
Well, you'd think that books would be less relevant. But if you study the Ukrainian war of the present day, you see so many phenomena that we associate with the Second World War, libraries being destroyed by bombing, a flight to the West, leaving all your collections of books behind, libraries being used to teach Russian-speaking Ukrainian citizens Ukrainian when they go out, the paper being scarce and more costly, white writers being weaponized on both sides, and Ukrainians taking into central collecting points their Russian language books so that they can be pulped for reuse. Or every aspect of that is 20th century, even if the war is being fought with 21st century weapons.
Andrew, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, it's been a real pleasure.
Andrew Pettigrew is an award-winning author and professor of modern history at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. We've been talking about his new book. It's called The Book at War, How Reading Shaped Conflict and Conflict-Shaped Reading. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Environmental Protection Agency took steps this week toward a complete ban of asbestos after 30 years of trying. We'll find out why. First, more than 20,000 people living in Wisconsin have cases pending in immigration court that could result in deportation. The vast majority of those people won't be represented by a lawyer. As Sarah Lear reports, there's a growing and unmet demand for immigration attorneys in Wisconsin and across the country.
On a recent spring afternoon, more than 30 people file into the basement of a church in Madison. Some carry babies and strollers and slings. They settle into plastic chairs as attorney Aisa Olivares of the Community Immigration Law Center cues up a slideshow. The people in the crowd are new arrivals to the U.S. Some are seeking asylum. That means they need to prove they left their home countries because they fear persecution for characteristics like their race or their politics. They typically have a year to turn in government paperwork. The form must be completed in English. And the process often involves recounting trauma, like imprisonment, sexual assault, or torture. They need help. But with only 3 attorneys on staff, the center doesn't have the resources to give one-on-one legal advice to everyone. Paralegal Diana Benitez says the nonprofit has no choice but to turn many people away.
It's desperate. It's just the level of desperation people have when they come to speak with you is just really, is palpable. It's just, you can see it on your face.
In 2019, there were more than 1 million pending U.S. immigration cases. Today, that backlog has surpassed 3 million. Sue Long directs the Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse, which analyzed the federal data. She says insufficient court funding is partly to blame.
They haven't had the budget to increase the number of immigration judges and support staff that are needed to hold hearings and make decisions. compared to increasing the budget, for example, for the Border Patrol.
And when immigrants end up in court, data also shows they're less likely to have lawyers. 5 years ago, immigrants nationwide had legal representation in 65% of pending deportation cases. Now, only 30% do. In the U.S., criminal defendants have a right to an attorney, but that right does not apply to immigration cases. Annie Chen is with the Vera Institute of Justice, a left-leaning think tank. She says the system has created an imbalance.
The government is always represented by a trained attorney, but the immigrant is often in immigration court alone.
When immigrants have attorneys, studies show they're more likely to be released on bond if they're detained. They're also less likely to be deported. Barb Graham oversees refugee and immigration legal services for Catholic Charities in Milwaukee. It's one of a handful of organizations in Wisconsin that handles immigration cases on a free or pro bono basis. Graham says her clients can't afford to pay thousands of dollars for complicated and lengthy cases.
People who are applying for asylum have left everything. They come up with nothing. They have no access to money. They have no access to, you know, they didn't come with their bank account.
But even when people can afford to pay, Graham says private immigration attorneys can be in short supply. Border Patrol encounters with migrants at the southern border reached a record high last year. And Milwaukee immigration attorney Teddy Chadwick says demand for his services has risen exponentially.
I have court hearings that are scheduled out till 2028 and 2029.
Faced with a backlog, Chadwick says there's often nothing immigrants or asylum seekers can do to make their cases go faster. And he says those cases can be all but impossible to navigate without an attorney. Sarah Lear, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. The EPA announced new rules this week that would lead to a complete ban on asbestos in American manufacturing. The rule would remove the last form of asbestos in use in the country. The naturally occurring mineral is still used in some products in the U.S. in spite of being responsible for 40,000 deaths each year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or a loved one had mesothelioma or another illness from asbestos? Do you think it should be completely banned? Do you work in a line of work where you encounter asbestos often? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Crispin Pierce is a professor of public health and environmental studies at UW-Eau Claire. Crispin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for this opportunity to talk about asbestos.
And asbestos is off the market in most cases where people, I think, would run into it in home use and things like that. What kind of things are we still doing with this one kind of asbestos that's leading this EPA rule?
Right. Well, this kind of asbestos, amongst all the types in American homes, is about 95% used generally as insulation. So we're talking about insulating pipes, boilers, ducts, flues, and even insulation for electrical and heating purposes.
Right. That we don't so much do anymore, right? If I'm getting new insulation, it's probably not going to be asbestos, but the old stuff might well have asbestos.
Indeed, that's exactly correct. Also, some brake parts, aftermarket parts, brake linings, and clutch linings still do contain asbestos. So we're talking about an older house stock, buildings built before in the 1950s, even in the 1960s and earlier, still have these asbestos-clad pipes, vents, ducts in their basements often.
What is the health hazard from asbestos? We see estimates, as I mentioned, of 40,000 deaths a year. What is it about the substance that makes it a health hazard?
It's actually the shape and the chemical properties of asbestos. It's a naturally occurring mineral, one of the most common in the soil. We think about 100,000 people worldwide die each year, and there are about 100,000 Americans who were exposed during shipbuilding that are affected. It's very difficult for the lung to clear, so the ratio is at least five times as long as they are wide. So they get deep into the lung, and they're very, very difficult to remove. So the typical diagnostic tool is to do a chest x-ray and see these dense particles in people's lungs. The true actual way to find out if somebody died of asbestos or mesothelioma is actually during autopsy. Mm-hmm. We can actually cut open the body and actually see the asbestos fibers that have accumulated in lung tissue.
And obviously it sounds like they don't go away on their own.
That's right. It's a terminal disease, very, very sad disease, to difficult to treat. It's causes difficulty breathing related to emphysema, and it's untreatable. It's a disease that we know a lot more than we did 50 years ago, but sadly, we don't have a treatment for it.
What are the properties of asbestos that made it so useful, that it was so widely used in so many different ways?
Right. It's been used for about 5,000 years, starting with the fins and used in pots because it's very strong. It doesn't catch fire. It insulates both with heat and electricity. So it's been a very valuable tool, for example, in World War II during shipbuilding for the insides of ships, the pipes, the steam boilers, the ducts, and very valuable in homes. So it's a very valuable product for many industrial uses. Again, as I mentioned, brake linings and clutch linings. But now we know, just like we know about lead, that it causes major health effects.
One of the industries that's still using this, that's been objecting to this ban, at least the timeline of it, is the industry that makes chlorine to be used for drinking water, for sanitizing drinking water. I just learned this from this EPA rule. Part of that industry still uses these asbestos filters in the process. This sounds like something that can be replaced. There are other ways to make the chlorine that we use for drinking water. How big a worry do you have? How big a burden do you think it could be to change those remaining industries over?
Yes, I think that's what's happening right now. So the ban is on importation of chrysotile asbestos, one of the six forms of asbestos. And as you mentioned, that is used in the production of clean drinking water and chlorine, which we use to sanitize most of the water in this country. So there is going to be a phase-out time frame in which the EPA works with industries to find better ways to produce this. And there are several new ways to actually produce this chlorine, not using the asbestos jackets or membranes.
Now, this new ban from the EPA, you know, this is the final rule. There's a procedure. It takes a little while for it to be implemented. It's under a Toxic Substance Control Act of 1976. This goes back a long way. The EPA had tried to crack down on this before. The Supreme Court, I believe, said, no, that's overreaching that law. Congress passed a new toxic substance law in 2016. Can you talk a little bit about the long history of efforts to rein in asbestos?
Well, it's typical to many substances in our environment that have been very useful to industry. So, for example, lead was very valuable, even DDT if we look internationally. Both of those substances have really valuable uses. Lead in terms of lead paint stays on longer, it looks better, it's more attractive. DDT because it is effective in treating mosquitoes. So there's been this balance between EPA regulation and then the people who use asbestos, like W.R. Grace and Company. And it's unfortunately to me as a toxicologist, it's a little frustrating because we don't always deal with things based upon just their health risk, their economic benefits to many industries. So there's a balance between how EPA regulates and how industry responds. And we're seeing that balance play out now with asbestos.
Crispin Pierce is a professor of public health and environmental studies at UW-Eau Claire. He's talking to us about EPA's new asbestos ban rule that was announced this week. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you glad to see this action? Do you worry about asbestos? Have you or a loved one suffered health consequences from it? Have you had to do asbestos remediation in a building, your own home, or maybe a workplace? Or do you work in asbestos remediation? Love to hear from you, too. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Crispin Pierce, public health and environmental studies professor at UW-Eau Claire, about the EPA's asbestos ban, the final rule announced this week. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts on the idea of banning asbestos. If you have work or worked somewhere where you encounter asbestos, let us know about it, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Carolyn is with us in La Crosse. Carolyn, hi.
Hi. I have 8-inch square linoleum on my kitchen floor, and somebody mentioned to me that that linoleum tile has asbestos in it, or maybe the glue.
C- Carolyn, thanks for the call. Crispin, I'm not sure. I know you mentioned at home we might encounter asbestos in insulation. Might we encounter it in various kinds of tile, linoleum or otherwise?
Yes, Carolyn, that's not uncommon. Even at the university here, we have asbestos in the tile. The principal issue is whether or not it becomes airborne. So if the tile is in good condition, if it's covered up by carpet in case at a university, it's not a health risk. It's when those particles get airborne, it's called being friable, that we have concerns. So I would suggest that if your tile, linoleum tile, is in good condition, you shouldn't be concerned. If it's starting to break up or you're going to do some remodeling, get an asbestos contractor to come in, see if asbestos is in the tile, and then get it properly remediated.
Carolyn, thanks a lot for the call. Hope that helped. Kathy is with us in Johnson Creek. Kathy, hi.
Hi. I just have a quick question for the gentleman. A friend of mine who did unfortunately pass away, she worked in the art room, and she had said before she passed, I bought, you know, the lining of my organs, that's where it came from, and that was her intuition. And then I read recently in New York Times, they're discussing the lining of your organs affected from asbestos. And I was wondering what the gentleman read about that, because, or knew about that, because he talks about the lungs and, you know, airborne, but it affects the lungs, but it also affects the lining of your organs.
And Kathy, I'm sorry to hear that. I just want to clarify, your friend thought that asbestos was a factor for her?
She did. She goes, I was very healthy. She ate well. And she said, the only thing I've ever been exposed to is that crazy kiln room where they had, you know, the low ceilings and dust was all over the place.
Kathy, thanks a lot for the call. Crispin, you talked about the impact on lungs. Can asbestos affect other organs as well?
Yeah, thank you very much, Kathy. I'm very sorry for the loss of your friend. Asbestos does cause a disease called mesothelioma, which is the lining of the lung. So indeed, on a chest x-ray, if we see scarring, the beginning of, it's called interstitial fibrosis, but basically scarring of the lung and the no longer functioning of the lung, and that can lead to inflammation and then the kind of cancer called mesothelioma. So indeed, that would be diagnosed again with a chest x-ray to actually look at the fibers and where they may have been placed in the lung.
Kathy, thanks for that call. Mesothelioma is the one I've heard of most. Crispin, are there other health consequences of asbestos that might not be included just in the numbers for mesothelioma?
Yes, asbestos causes irritation, inflammation, and scarring of the lung tissue. So chronic obstructive lung disease, emphysema, difficulty breathing are sadly all the consequences of this kind of fibrous material. Similar things with silicosis, flour and dust in industrial setting, a long-term exposure to all of these substances, these solid substances, can cause that scarring and lack of function of the lung.
Kathy, thanks for that call. Barbara joins us now in Wauwatosa. Barbara, hi. What did you want to bring up?
The literature still seems mixed on the crestotile of whether it was good asbestos or bad asbestos and the long-term health effects. And it always says that the macrophages will remove the crestotile from your body. But then they'll say, oh, it could be a 50-year or 40-year time bomb waiting to go off. So is it truly a health hazard? And is it underdiagnosed when people have been? I mean, it just seems like it's out there, dangerous, and not really given a lot of, weight.
Barbara, you mentioned this literature make a distinction between good and bad asbestos. What would the good asbestos be as that's described? You mentioned use in epoxy.
The long fiber versus the short-term fiber.
Gotcha.
Some of the paints and epoxy adhesives, they used a super fine grind.
Gotcha.
And they said that it was easily removed through the macrophage process in your lung. And I would highly doubt. I would think the smaller the fiber, the deeper it could get in your lung tissue.
Barbara, thanks for the call. Crispin, is this something you've looked at, shorter fiber asbestos, but the argument being maybe less harmful?
You know, thank you, Barbara, for the question. All six forms of asbestos, including chrysotile, serpentine, all of these are considered carcinogenic by the EPA and the Institute for Research on Cancer, IARC. The difficulty sometimes is that there's a latency period, about 20 years for most asbestos-caused cancers. So it's sometimes difficult to associate a particular exposure with the appearance of disease because that may take 20 years. But all forms of asbestos are considered carcinogenic in humans.
Thanks for that call, Barbara. Lyric is with us in Blanchardville. Lyric, hi.
Hi, I live in Blanchardville, and I had a building that needed to be demolished, and I got a lot of variance of $40,000, $50,000 in demolishing the building, and finally a nice contractor out of Mount Horeb advised me, he said, you need to get a hold of the state of Wisconsin, has a list of licensed contractors who will first come and take lab samples and send them to a licensed lab, and when that comes back, we know what's dangerous and that's been removed, and you use a licensed person or company to remove the asbestos from your home. That finished for me in just this last just before Thanksgiving, day before Thanksgiving of November, and it cost $35,000 to go through that process. Now what happens is people cheat, and other people they don't believe in the disease that it causes. And also, they have contractors who say, oh, if you've got a hose nearby, I'll just hose the building down and keep the dust down. And they're putting it in landfills close to waters, and it's going right into our water systems.
Lyric, thanks a lot for the call. Chris, but Lyric speaking, I think, to the importance of doing it right when you're tearing down stuff with asbestos in it.
Absolutely right, Lyric. Thank you for the call. It is a major concern in part because we don't see this. We don't see asbestos fibers unless there's a very high concentration. We like to go to the State Lab of Hygiene in Madison, and for a low cost, they will provide materials for you to collect samples and send them in. Indeed, I would go with a licensed asbestos inspector and contractor to do this work. Again, as I mentioned before, the latency period means that after demolition, it may be 10 or 20 years before we start to see the appearance of disease. But particularly in that circumstance, when we're having a lot of airborne materials, we just took down two dorms on University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire campus, and all the asbestos was removed ahead of time. And then we did some testing for look at what was in the air afterwards. But certainly go with a licensed contractor or the State Lab of Hygiene to collect those samples to see if asbestos still remains on the site.
Lyric, thanks for that call. Crispin, a few minutes ago, you mentioned silicosis, and I know this is something you've worked on, the risks associated with silica particles in the air and workplaces and elsewhere. I've seen arguments that we've underestimated the risks. What kind of things are you looking at?
Well, our work actually for the last decade or so has been around frac sand mines in Wisconsin. And what we've done is we put air monitors near these facilities to look up what the concentration of what's called PM2.5, fine particulates, are in the air. We actually have found some risk that leads to a small decline in life expectancy for people who are exposed to these kind of particles. Silica, and particularly crystalline silica, is particularly dangerous in this regard. So what we have done is we've installed about 50 monitors around the state of Wisconsin, so people are empowered to find out what's in their air.
And how about at workplaces that work with different kinds of silica sand? That seems like the highest risk of acute exposure.
You're exactly right, Rob. I appreciate that. So we get most of our data about understanding how people get sick from silica or asbestos from occupational settings. People who were shipbuilders back in the 1940s, people who do crushing or grinding pottery work with silica, who work with this on a regular, a daily basis or a lifetime. That's how we estimate the relationship between what's in the air, the concentration, and the risk of disease.
In our last few moments, Crispin, getting back to asbestos, how long are we going to be dealing with this as a health concern, even as this one last kind gets banned?
I'm hopeful that this is a major step forward. Again, the major type of asbestos was now banned for import in the United States. I'm hopeful that we will continue as a society, and the Environmental Protection Agency continues to advise us of the kind of risks of other kinds of asbestos. So I'm actually quite hopeful with this major step forward to protect homeowners, to protect workers, to protect people in neighborhoods from asbestos exposure.
Crispin, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you, Rob.
That's Crispin Pierce, professor of public health and environmental studies at UW-Eau Claire. He talked with us about the EPA's asbestos ban with final rules released this week. And we looked at the history of the use of asbestos and why it is such a health risk in the first place. If you have experience with this, maybe in the workplace yourself, still interested in hearing your story, you can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, get a preview of Wisconsin's April elections, from a presidential primary to many local elections around the state for mayors, school boards, city councils, and more. You can join the conversation. Let us know what's going on in your part of the state. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. If you're going to design a successful video game, you got to know your audience. If they don't want to play it, it's not going to catch on. What if the audience is parrots? As reported in the New York Times science section, researchers at Northeastern University worked to develop a touchscreen game that parrots can play. Why? One, for some animals, touchscreen tablets could help with researching the way they think and problem solve. Two, researchers hope that cool games could actually help enrich the lives of pet animals. This game tested parrots by rewarding them with treats if they used their tongue to click red circles quickly and accurately. Peanut butter, yogurt, or pine nuts were the treat selections. Interestingly, different parrots only wanted to play for particular treats. One didn't care about the treats at all, only played for praise and encouragement. This game isn't the final product. It was a first step to figure out how parrots would interact with screens. Hey, I'd play a simple game for treats. Probably wouldn't lick the screen to win it, though. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Americans have plenty of concerns about issues facing the country right now. For many, immigration has moved to the forefront. Recent polling from Gallup found that Americans rated immigration as the most important problem facing the country today, with 28% picking that as their top concern. That's driven almost completely by Republicans putting the issue at the top of their list. It's the first time immigration has taken that top spot in the survey in the last 5 years. Other top concerns in the survey include the government, inflation, and the economy, but the issue of immigration has seen the largest increase in recent months. You might expect immigration to be the biggest concern for people who live near the border, and that's true, but the Midwest had fairly high levels of concern over immigration as well. So how is it that public opinion on national issues like this can shift so much, even in parts of the country that might not be as directly affected by something like immigration? Our next guest studies public opinion and political behavior. She's here to help us understand how people form their attitudes toward big issues like this. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Why do you think immigration has risen to the top of the list for many people? What do you see as the most important problem facing the country? How do you weigh issues when they're out there? Who do you look to get information, to get advice on what to make of big things facing the country right now? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Christina LaPlante is an assistant professor of political science and public administration at UW La Crosse. Christina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Why do you think immigration has moved up to the top of this list? This is the Gallup poll, a long-running poll. Other surveys seem to show similar things. Why do you think immigration has risen to the top here in many ways?
Well, yeah, it's really shocking the quick jump that public opinion has made on this issue in particular. And I think to understand what's going on here, we really have to take a step back and look at how do people form political attitudes? And we have lots of theories about how this happens in political science, but I think the one that explains what's going on right now best is simply just looking at the power that elite political discourse and messaging has on public opinion. So, you know, when we're talking about political elites, not only are we talking about people like politicians and candidates for office, but, you know, we're talking about what's on the evening broadcast. We're talking about what are you listening to on the radio on the drive home, right? And it's exactly this conversation that we're having right now. So I think that just the overemphasis of the border crisis right now is really driving the effect that we're seeing right now. It's a really salient issue. I mean, we could talk about the historic bipartisan bill that passed the Senate and was on its way to the House until Trump interjected and said, oh, we can't have Biden having a success on the border. That would be detrimental to my campaign. So I think we see both candidates really trying to make this a galvanizing issue for their bases.
And you mentioned that bill. The Gallup polling made a point of saying, yeah, we were out in the field while this was playing out in Congress. So it may be that more than anything put that front and center in people's minds. This was the big political issue in the nation's capital over the course of that week.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And I also want to emphasize that, you know, depending on what's going on in the moment, that has a big impact on how we perceive issues and the extent to which we weight those issues. So for any given voter, there's a variety of issues that are important to them, right? But we are inundated. Most Americans are inundated with a to-do list. You know, when is the next kid's dentist appointment? When do I have to take the dog to the vet? When is the big project at work due? On top of that, staying politically informed is a high order. So when we get the random phone call and actually decide to participate in those polls from Gallup or from Pew, and they ask us, hey, what's the biggest issue for you right now? We have this metaphor of the bucket analogy in political science. You know, people just reach into the bucket. They're grabbing what's most readily accessible. And that's probably going to be what they read in the paper this morning or what they listened to on the radio on the drive to work or what was playing on the evening news the night before. And with the overemphasis on the border in our current media landscape, it's not surprising that voters are reacting this way. And we're seeing this be a top issue.
Now, some might challenge the idea of an overemphasis because of circumstances with crime in Central America, climate change in a lot of the world. There are large numbers of people coming to the U.S. border, in most cases, to seek amnesty. Is there something about just the reality that because of various global forces, people are showing up at the border in large numbers, larger than they had over the last few years?
Oh, of course. But what I want to emphasize is the framing by which media outlets are talking about the issue. You mentioned earlier that a lot of this effect is being driven by Republican voters. Why is that? And now I'm starting to feel a little depressed because every time y'all invite me on here, I start inevitably talking about fear messaging and anger messaging, but I'm about to do that again right now. When we look, I don't think anyone would disagree that the American news media landscape is highly polarized. And what that means is that when we have conservative outlets, they're going to talk about issues in a way that's advantageous to their party. Many Americans look at the Republican Party and they say they're tough on crime and they're good at handling international crises and conflict. So it's not surprising when we are seeing conservative-leaning news outlets talk about the border and immigration. They do so from an economic burden frame, and they do so from a crime and safety frame, because many voters perceive the Republicans to be really legitimate and good on those issues. When we look at liberal media outlets, what do we see them do? They emphasize the humanitarian crisis, and that makes people feel really sad about the border. So we have to understand, like, how are people being exposed to these messages? What is the underlying emotion, and how does that drive opinion?
Christina LaPlante is with us from UW-La Crosse, political scientist there, talking about how we shape our opinions on big issues, especially the issue of immigration. According to Gallup and other pollsters, it's risen as a top issue of concern for American voters, Republicans in particular. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Christina, an interesting distinction here. A lot of pollsters talk about illegal immigration. And when I talk to immigration experts, things have changed in some ways. The picture we might have of illegal immigration is people crossing the border and trying not to be detected, not to be caught by border security to come into the United States. Now, the most common thing is people coming to the border presenting themselves in hopes of making an amnesty claim. But when we use a phrase like illegal immigration, is that, I don't know, putting us in a different template, a different mindset when we think about the issue?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I would agree that, again, the terminology that's used, the emotional frame, all of that is done for a specific strategic advantage, right? We know that Democrats, when we think about contemporary liberal political ideology in America, we tend to think of that redistributive nature of the Democrats, right? That, you know, we care about intersectionality and diversity and helping the most disadvantaged people rise up. And so it's not surprising that when we look at the way that liberal news media outlets are talking about this type of issue, we're not using the terminology illegal immigrants, right? We're talking about people seeking amnesty. So I agree that it's really important, I think, for voters to pick up on these nuances and to try to understand, you know, what is the strategy? What's the deeper motivation from this story? How is it trying to influence me? I think we need to be a lot more aware of how politicians and news media, how they try to influence our opinions versus how are they trying to educate us on the issue.
As you mentioned, we're busy people with a lot on our minds. I mean, even, you know, I'm in the media, and I think I often kind of passively absorb things. I don't step back and take a few minutes to engage my media literacy to break down messages. How can we do that without shutting down our lives to ponder each and every issue?
I'm glad that you asked that question. I think it's a really good one. It's something that I tell my students every time we're approaching campaign season, and it's really just like a stop and think. I need to come up with something catchy that's like a stop, drop, and roll, because I think that's really what we need to do. Anytime you come across a headline, you're reading something, you hear something, you see something, and you feel this gut reaction that automatically leads you to feel angry or sad or fearful or anxious, any type of emotion like that, I think we need to stop, think, reassess, because 9 times out of 10, there is some type of political motivation or agenda underlying that, right? They're trying to grab our attention, make us feel fearful, make us feel angry, and there's an agenda behind that. And I think the more that we can just be mindful of when that's happening and assess that, I think we would all be a lot better off.
We're talking to UW La Crosse political science professor Christina LaPlante about how we form our opinions about big political issues. As recent polling found immigration as a rising concern for Americans, particularly Republicans, in recent Gallup and other polling. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have some version of a stop, drop, and roll when you see a political advertisement, hear part of a political speech, or reporting from outlets, whether you consider them reliable or not? Why do you think immigration has risen to the top of this list? 28% of Americans in the Gallup poll say it's their top issue. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Christina LaPlante, Assistant Professor of Political Science and Public Administration at UW La Crosse. She's with us today to talk about how we form our attitudes and opinions toward big political issues, with recent surveys from Gallup finding immigration the top concern among Americans for the first time since 2019, with 28% of Americans putting it at the top of their list, driven largely by an increase in Republicans citing it as the top issue. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions about all this at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Paul is with us in Northern Illinois. Paul, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
I always love your show. Christina brought up a great point as far as the framing of this, and I'm wondering, and obviously different messages from different parties, some things bizarrely seem liberal when they're conservative and vice versa, but has anyone considered the net positive that illegal and legal immigrants bring to the country as far as our GDP and workforce?
Gotcha, Paul. Thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, I have read some economic and analyst Christina saying we're not in a recession right now because we've had jobs filled by migrants, by immigrants of various sorts. Can you talk about the economic side of the framing when it comes to our conversations about immigration?
Yeah, what an excellent question. I appreciate Paul calling in with that. It's really interesting. Again, like I mentioned earlier, you know, there's three big frames that we can look at when we're trying to break down how people are talking about and thinking about immigration. So there's the economic burden frame, there's the security and crime frame, and then there's the humanitarian concern frame. And what's interesting is that, like, at each of those levels, there is still, while one tends to be emphasized by one ideology more than the other, there's still a partisan split on each of those narratives. So Paul's absolutely right that there is kind of a more liberal take on this economic frame that let's talk about the economic advantages that immigrants can bring to our country. But I think on the more conservative side, we generally see the economic frame that immigrants can present this burden to our economy. And you know, what it used to be in like a decade or so ago was that, you know, immigrants, when they come to this country illegally, they take our jobs. That's kind of less of the rhetoric that we see today. And it's more a different kind of threat frame. It's more the idea that people believe that immigrants, when they come to this country illegally, that they strain our resources, that they may perhaps, again, you just take other resources that could be available to Americans, that I'm spending my tax dollars on, you know, medical bills for illegal immigrants who aren't even here legally. So it takes on, the debate has certainly evolved in an interesting way, I would say.
Thanks for that call, Paul. And Paul reminds me of, this was in a Monmouth University poll. Monmouth asked people about their thoughts on immigrants and their impact on jobs. 28% of the public said that illegal immigrants, as they phrased it, take jobs away from American citizens. 62% says that these immigrants fill jobs that Americans don't want. That's an interesting framing that I guess I wouldn't have expected, given a lot of the other conversation and framing around immigration, Christina.
Sure. Yeah. And I think what you're seeing there is kind of like actually some degree of class consciousness, right? This idea that when we're talking about low paying jobs, that's where the opinions tend to center on.
Let's go back to our callers. Nancy is with us in Wausau. Nancy, hi.
Hi there. My comment goes more along the lines of humanitarianism. You know, when we, American, I should say we, but American corporations go over to somewhat poorer countries and destroy their environment, destroy their water with, say, poor mining practices, because they can go there and get away with it, make a big buck and leave the land ravaged. Where do you think these people are supposed to come? Of course, they're going to come here. And, you know, I feel that we have a responsibility to help them.
Nancy, thanks for the call. Interesting way of looking at it, Christina. I don't think people always connect the dots between American business and foreign policy in the past and migration today. There is a connection, though.
Oh, absolutely. And what a great point that is. And I think it just further highlights the power of these threat messages and how effective they are and how they can essentially put blinders on us from engaging in that more kind of critical thinking thought process. And to be clear, you know, this isn't something that's unique to immigration. On hot button issues, we see politicians kind of across the board do this. And something that's interesting now is that we see Democrats engaging in a lot more threat-based, fear-based messaging than we have in the past. And a big example of that is how we talk about women's reproductive rights and this idea that you know, if you don't vote and you don't participate in every single election, this is going to continue to happen. Women, you are going to lose your rights. And of course, like, that's a very frightening threat-based message. And then that's where the conversation tends to focus on. And then we put our blinders on and we refuse to acknowledge opinions or attitudes that might be different from ours because we've been presented with this message that in and of itself is an existential threat. So it really what all of this does is it just continues to drive polarization and prevent any type of compromise or discussion across party lines on the issue. So great point.
Thanks for that call. Christina LaPlante is with us, political scientist at UW La Crosse, talking about how we shape our opinions on big issues. Christina, you just mentioned polarization. I think a lot of times when news outlets and academics and others get people talking, they find that opinions are mixed. People have more mixed feelings or moderate feelings, or they're torn two ways on issues. But once a political argument starts or a campaign starts, we attach ourselves to the issue on our side, dig in, and move away from that middle ground. Do you see that as the phenomenon in part driving polarization?
Absolutely. And think about how we are modeling how to discuss these issues across party lines, you know, among political elites, right? Look at presidential debates, for example. You know, it used to be, I would say, you know, a couple election cycles ago that there were, you know, give and take and listen and respond in our presidential debates. And now they've really just kind of boiled down to these screaming matches, and they're very uncomfortable to watch. And I think when that's the type of behavior that's modeled, you know, you are sending the message that this is how we talk about politics, and anyone who disagrees with you, they're just a moron. And we've got to change that, right? So we've got to start holding politicians and elites accountable. Oh my God. And you can also look at the way that some news outlets will invite guests on to talk about issues. And it's just ridiculous. So we got to start doing a better job of modeling how to have these conversations if we want to fix polarization.
And Christina, I've heard a lot about negative partisanship when it comes to candidates, meaning I'm going to vote not for my candidate, but against the other party's candidate. Do you think that applies to issues as well? When someone sees, oh, the other side feels this way on that issue, therefore I ought to feel the other way.
Yeah, I think that that's a really pervasive and really unfortunate paradigm that's growing to characterize American politics right now. And again, it boils down to this idea that, you know, we know that when we make people angry, there's been lots of studies done on this in political science, that when we make people angry, they're much more likely to participate in politics. Anger is a very externalizing, mobilizing emotional state to be in. When you're angry, you don't want to be in that state. You want to do something. You want to be active and get out of it. And that's why I get really nervous when I see Democrats kind of default to this sad hopelessness messaging. Because when you're sad, well, you don't want to get up and do anything about that. How many of you have laid in your bed being sad and then thought to yourself, man, I really got to get up and do something about this sadness? Sadness is an internalizing, demobilizing emotion. And both of the parties are becoming pretty aware of this, which is why just everything, every issue, everything that we talk about is all saturated with anger, because political strategists know that's going to mobilize people, get them energized, and get them out participating in politics. So yeah, it's not surprising that this concept of negative partisanship is so heavily embedded in like every dimension of American politics right now.
Christina, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. It's always a pleasure.
That's Christina LaPlante, Assistant Professor of Political Science and Public Administration at UW-La Crosse. She joined us today to talk about public opinion and how we form our attitudes toward big political issues like immigration and others. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, online forums and games and social media have been overwhelmed by toxic behavior. But there are some new strategies in the works to try to build a better online environment. An expert in online behavior digs into the latest efforts. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday with a look at some cooking gear. Get advice on choosing the right skillet for the right job. If you're a cook and there's a skillet that you have a strong personal bond with, let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.